Well, this has been an exciting week to talk about money. Considering major companies lost half of their value or regained part of their value and all kinds of other things. For those of you who have been traipsing around the world, we kind of started talking about this back in the book of Numbers as we're surveying the Bible. And we noticed that the book of Numbers was referred to a number of times in the New Testament. So we looked at two passages where it spent almost the whole chapter or two on the book of Numbers. One was 1 Corinthians 10, and the second was the book of Hebrews chapters 3 and 4. And one of the major emphases in Hebrews 3 and 4 is the importance of being faithful. So we started doing a series on faithfulness. And we started looking at the various things that God desires that we be faithful in. So we looked at the general principle of faithfulness. We looked at the principle of being faithful with your time, because God owns all your time. And you need to use your time according to His purposes. And you exchange that interval that we call time for something of eternal value, hopefully, or something that's kind of useless. So a wise person would exchange it for something of eternal value. And last week we started looking at the concept of being faithful with your money. The Bible talks more about money than heaven and hell put together. And we looked about how God really desires to bless us. So we got halfway through this sheet, and we'll pick it up there in a minute. In the future weeks we're going to look about what God says about how you spend your money. This is about how to get it. Then we'll look at being faithful with the experiences God has given you, your education, your background, live where you work. And then we'll look at being faithful with the truth, how to, God expects us to be able to pass on the truth that He's entrusted to us. So last week we looked at Roman numeral 1. You know, we don't own anything. God owns it all. He gives it to us and expects us to be faithful with it. Similarly to our time, we really can't create our time. It's given to us, and we have to be faithful to it. God owns our lives as well. Then Roman numeral 2, we looked at $1 million still isn't what it never used to be. You know, everybody used to think getting $1 million would be wonderful, but you know, it has its limitations. It's inferior to a lot of stuff, and it has dangers. So we got through page 1 last time, and I'm going to pick it up at the top of the second page under flypaper. One night around the dinner table, we were discussing our favorite Gary Larson cartoons. And one of the ones that's up there in the top 5 is the guy opens up the closet door, and in it are these two gigantic buffalo stuck on what looks like, you know, like sticky traps. And he calls out, "Honey, we got a couple more." And there's this buffalo, and he's got, you know, he's looking at his hoof, and it's stuck to this gluey stuff. And you know, just the thought of catching buffaloes on sticky paper creates some of the humor. If you're a Gary Larson cart fan, you will know and think it's really funny. If you're not, you're going, huh? All right, odd humor. But the idea is that money is a flypaper, a glue trap. You kind of get into it, and it has this appeal, and it's really hard to let go of it. And back in Jesus' day, they didn't have buffaloes getting stuck on flypaper, one of the great tragedies of ancient history. But Jesus did say in Luke 18:23 to the rich young ruler, who was told he needed to part with some of the stuff he had. When he heard this, he was very sorrowful, for he was very rich. And when Jesus saw that he was very sorrowful, he said, "How hardly shall they that have riches enter the kingdom of God?" It's tough because people trust in their riches rather than trusting in the eternal God. Sleeplessness is another disadvantage or danger of wealth. Solomon said, who owned a lot of stuff, Ecclesiastes 5:12, "The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep." This was particularly driven home to us on, I think it was Thursday night. Jill and I always get these invitations in the mail to these investment dinners, and it's a cheap date. You know, you go out, they feed you at a nice place, and you know, they talk to you about, you know, giving them all your money. So you know, it's you know, a great way to invest in our future by not spending money on dinner. We go to these things. So we went to one of these things on Thursday, and there was a big hotshot regional director for a private security firm called Lord Abbott, and he was brought in to quell investor fears about what the market was doing. And he had all these charts and all these statistics about, you know, how the markets worked and how this correction's within certain ranges and blah, 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 blah. And there's nothing really to be worried about. And then he tells us that he hasn't been able to sleep. Even though he knows all this stuff, he's got the proof and evidence of all this stuff, the guy couldn't sleep. And talk about how he's up at 3 a.m. waiting for CNN to come on, and just like, yeah. So, what do I listen to? His numbers or, his actual visceral reaction to the market? He talked about all his friends had the same problem. Money can also cause hurt to people, and we've seen it damage folks. The stories of how the second generation of wealthy parents do really poorly is so true. Ecclesiastes 5:13, this is a severe evil which I've seen under the sun, namely riches kept for their owners to their hurt. And money can do all kinds of damage to folks. In my classes this week, we're looking at the factors that cause the rise and fall of civilizations. And one of those is economic surplus. And that causes a nation to rise and a nation to fall. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But I try to bring it down to a personal level that the principles that we look at for nations are also applicable to individuals. And we talked about individuals who have lots of money. And since I'm going to be doing happiness this week, in the next 2 weeks I'm setting it up, talk about people who have lots of fame and people who have lots of opportunities for pleasure. We're talking about celebrities. And we talk about people who frequently are in rehab places and addicted to drugs and kill themselves. It's the same folks. That they have all this stuff, but it actually winds up hurting them. A person who gains riches can kind of start thinking of themselves as better than their own. That's called pride. We all know that's a sin. Proverbs 28:11, the rich man is wise in his own conceit. Can lead to emptiness, hence the need for escapism among the celebrity and other populations. Luke 1:53, God fills the hungry with good things. He comes to their aid. He rescues them. He satisfies them. He lets them know he's their good shepherd watching out for them. But the rich he sends away empty. And later on in that same book, 6:24, woe to you who are rich, you've received your reward, you don't have much to look forward to. Be an error and a snare to have lots of wealth. 1 Timothy 6:9, those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, into many foolish and harmful lusts, just look at our tabloids, which drown men in destruction and perdition, King James, sorry about that. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. It's going to be the verse at the top of next week when we look at how we're supposed to spend our money. For which some, loving money, have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Scripture says it's a root of all kinds of evil. That means it gives rise to a bunch of evil. We're not going to be immune to it. We need to tend our gardens well. Money can lead to idolatry, which Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 6:24. You can't serve two masters. You're going to love one, hate the other. You can't be loyal to both of them. You can't serve God and mammon. Take your pick. It can give you a sense of false confidence and joy, and this is actually a bad thing. As Job is defending himself before his friends that he's righteous, he says in Job 31:24, if I've made gold my hope, or I've said to fine gold, you are my confidence, and if I rejoiced because my wealth was great, and because my hand had gotten much, then you go all the way to verse 28, which is on some of your sheets. I think it's 20, not of mine either, but it says, then I deserve the judgment I get. But Job had not done this. But a person who rejoices in this stuff, particularly if they rejoice more than God, is worthy of judgment. You can place your trust in wealth, which is kind of a silly thing to place it in, but that shows up a lot, particularly in the Psalms, Psalm 49:6. There are people who put their trust in wealth and boast of their multitude of their riches, and they don't do well if you read the rest of the Psalm. Same thing in 52:7. This is the man that made not God his strength, but instead trusted in the abundance of his riches, strengthened himself in his great wickedness, didn't pay attention to God, and didn't do well. Or Psalm 62:10. Don't trust in oppression. If riches increase, don't set your heart on them, because they don't last. And this was a really good testimony to wealth not lasting. As I went to this dinner this week, the guy was saying that over the past 2,500 trading days, which is 10 years, if you had missed the top 10 days of the market, rather than making any money, you would have lost like 6%. And he said, the reason the market goes so way down because is people are just selling out, and then they miss the rebound, and just poof, goes away. I heard the controller for the city of New York talking about how they had a number of investments in AIG and in Lehman Brothers. And AIG went to half, boom, Lehman Brothers, I guess, went bye-bye. It's gone. Because fortunately, we're diversified. We only lost about $200 or $300 or $400 million. So this stuff does go away pretty fast. It's not really a good thing to trust it. And you kind of want to trust in the eternal God because he keeps going and going and going. Or is that the Energizer Bunny? I always get those two confused. One of the dangers of wealth is that you make the wrong purchases with it. You get things that aren't good for you. And passage I pulled out for this is in Acts 8. Peter said to Simon Magnus, you know, may your money purchase perish with you because you thought the gift of God could be purchased with money. Well, people aren't always just trying to purchase God's favor with money. They purchase a lot of other stupid things with money, some things that do them harm. As we were studying India for the debate, one of the possible ways to argue that the U.S. should change its foreign policy is in the area of micro-lending. Supposedly a really good thing. You loan people small amounts of money so they can do things with it, because one of the alleged causes of poverty, which we're going to get to in 10 minutes, is that they don't have access to capital. So we'll just give them capital. Well, the evidence against doing this, according to the cards that we have, is that they don't spend it on things that are asset producing. They actually just spend it on trinkets, iPods, and similar things that the evil capitalists sell them. So, and then they wind up acquiring debt, and it's just another foolish purchase. And frequently you'll see people who are in debt buying depreciating assets. They make wrong purchases. My students will come up to me around midterm time after they flunked it and say, well, I didn't have a textbook. And they're wearing sneakers that cost more than my textbook. My textbook's like, you know, it's an obscene price. It's like $80, $70, $80. But their sneakers are over $100. They managed to buy the wrong stuff. They didn't buy stuff that was wise. And then one of the dangers of having wealth is that as you acquire and accumulate it, it sets you up for judgment. Scary passage in James 5:1. Come now, you rich men, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. It's actually a pretty decent card, burst around in somebody's birthday card. Oh, there's a little encouraging verse. I'll look it up and see what it says. A couple others in the book of James that are good for that. Let me see, what's going to happen? Your riches are corrupted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and silver is cankered, and the rest of them will be a witness against them. So here's a person who had acquired wealth and didn't use it according to God's purposes, which we're going to learn about in the next 2 weeks. And as a result, it's just there to judge them on Judgment Day. You've heaped up treasure together for the last days, and it's going to be a witness against you. And it's probably not a good idea. So there are all these dangers to wealth. Limitations, it's inferior, you know, it causes problems, people who have it aren't happy, yet so many people still want to go after it. Why? Because it's a source of worth and value. It's a source of power. It's a source of security. It's a source of significance. It's a source of pleasure. And as I read my Bible, it's God who's supposed to give us all that stuff, and people just have... You know, nope, say, oh, I'm not an idolater, but basically, what are you looking for your power, security, significance, pleasure, and satisfaction in life? Your money or your God? You can't serve both, and that's choice. So we're going to look at a little bit more about how you get it, recognizing that it is a dangerous thing, and how you lose it. And then next week we'll look at more about how God wants you to spend it, how to give it to yourself, and the week after, how you give it to God. So I started considering what causes wealth, what causes poverty. And I asked my favorite theologians what causes these things, and around the dinner table they informed me it was money. Money causes wealth, and lack of money causes poverty. And that does it for me, end of sermon. Now that we know that, we're all blessed. Kind of recheck my theologians here. But in my Western Civ class, as we look at what causes economic surplus, we look through history to see what happens. And we discover some very interesting facts. In 1970, there's a country that some of you might be familiar with called South Korea. You know, it's a small little place somewhere in Asia. You know, maybe you know some people from there. And its GDP, the gross domestic product per person, was equal to that of a small African, or actually the same size African country called Zimbabwe. They both had a GDP of about $290 per person. Kind of small. All right, but then by 2004, which is 34 years later, Zimbabwe's GDP had actually kind of declined. It basically went to 351, but because of inflation, it's a net decline. While Korea increased almost 50%, I mean 50-fold, to like 14,000. So what's the difference? How is it that one country, you know, they start out equal, they have about the same size, how is it that one can suddenly progress and others can decline? And as much as some would like to think so, it really has very little to do with actually the quality of the people, because in every culture all around the world, you find people that come out of abject poverty, it's called pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, and attain fabulous wealth. All the studies have shown, you know, it's like independent of cultural, ethnic background. The author of this study, law professor Robert Miller, goes on to say that South Korea did not get rich and Zimbabwe did not get poor because the captains of industry and Wall Street bankers met in a smoke-filled room and decided they loved South Korea but hated Zimbabwe. No, the South Koreans got rich because they earned the riches and continue to do so. Zimbabweans are poor because they produce little. They produce less now than they did 20 years ago. So what factors tend to encourage economic growth? The rule of law, political stability, open markets, respect for property rights, and a well-educated, ambitious population. Yeah. Those are factors that are very, very similar to the stuff I do in my Western Civ class about what causes the rise and fall of civilizations. If things like economic surplus, principled military, constitutional government, moral code, and a leadership that serves its people. And then the question becomes, how do you get those things developed? Well, on a more micro level, but still not individual, I looked at what some of the community organizers and revitalizers say cause wealth and poverty. So I found a PhD who had compiled a number of studies on for community activists, people who want to revitalize community. And I have to read the quote from this, it's unbelievable. The factors of poverty as a social problem are listed here. Ignorance, disease, apathy, dishonesty, and dependency are seen to be simply as conditions. No moral judgment is intended. Excuse me, isn't dishonesty like a moral thing? And he goes on to explain that, you know, oh, no, it's you know, we're not getting made, no moral judgments here. He's not even saying these are causes. He refrains from doing it. He says, they're not good or bad, they just are. If it's a decision of a group of people in a society or community to reduce and remove poverty, they'll have to, without any value judgments, observe and identify these factors and take action to remove them as a way to eradicate poverty. As far as I understand, from a moral perspective, dishonesty is like bad. Yeah, that's like that there's a value that has to be made there. Apathy, I would also submit to you, for a biblical believer, is bad because you're supposed to be doing the will of God, doing it heartily. If you're apathetic, you've kind of missed it. Even ignorance and the causes. I have students that fail my course, so I look at what causes it. And it's usually a moral problem. They lack discipline. They lack faithfulness. They lack honoring their word. They cheat. Yeah, things like that. Those tend to be moral problems. All these things, you could argue, are moral problems. When this brilliant guy addresses the issue of disease, he talks about HIV, AIDS. And he says, who knows what causes it? It could be a CIA plot or come from eating monkey meat. Hello? Are those the major things that cause disease? It's like, so I really don't think this is the thinking, and I don't think this is actually going to solve it if you say these are just amoral things, but it's really a moral code issue. He then goes on to say these big five in turn contribute to secondary factors such as lack of markets, poor infrastructure, poor leadership, bad governments, underemployment, lack of skills, absenteeism, lack of capital, and all these other things. Well, at least he's not totally blaming, you know, big business for all the problems. But you need to think about, well, what causes wealth or what causes poverty? About the time the United States was trying to figure out how to be a nation, like 1776 for those of you who haven't had a history course lately, there's a guy in England called Adam Smith who actually wrote an inquiry into the causes of the wealth of nations. He was trying to figure out what caused it. One of the presuppositions here is that poverty is the default. So when you see wealth, you want to ask, what causes this kind of thing to happen? And, you know, his two big principles are. There's a division of labor. You know, people get good at the stuff they do. And then there are free and open markets. Well, as I was doing some studying for the debate prep on India, I came across something I had never heard of before. Back at the time Adam Smith was writing this, the GDP of India almost exceeded the GDP of Europe. India accounted for about a quarter of the world's GDP back in the late 1700s. By 1950, they accounted for 3.8%. What happened? Here this country was, it was doing incredibly well. That's why everybody wanted to get to India, they said. And then it just kind of falls apart. Then they get their independence, and it gets even worse. They adopt some communistic values. Nehru admired the communists. And the socialism policies that they put in almost put them over the verge of bankruptcy. And in the 90s, they fortunately got a guy who had been educated in Europe and understood a little bit of economics and started reversing it. And then today, India is like the fastest growing economy. It's going to be the most educated economy. They reversed these policies. They used to ban foreign investment, now they did it. And now India is doing well, and now they just have to worry about their inflation. But they're about in danger of defaulting as a nation as a result of these policies. So what was it that caused its rise and its fall? It was thinking. It was how they looked at things. It was policies. But what is it that causes the rise and fall of the wealth of individuals? And frequently, it's a thinking and mindset. It's a character set. The best research I came up with nailed it down to one word. It's called individualism. And it's really a function of the individual, their desire, their initiative, their responsibility, and stuff like that. And that corresponds pretty similarly to what I see in the Bible. You're going to see God blessing people, but who does he bless? He blesses people who are in a position to be blessed. One of the studies that I think is seminal for understanding the Bible is the stuff I have on the website on blessing. How to be in a spot to get blessed. Because God's thing is about blessing people. When he created them, he blessed them. That's what he does. He wants to move Israel into the promised land so he can bless them. And for individual believers today, he wants to bless them. So what do you have to do to get blessed? And basically, it's pretty simple. Obey. Roman numeral 3, wealth is a consequence of obedience, which leads to blessing. Proverbs 10:22, it's the blessing of the Lord that makes rich. And you get rich without sorrow added to it. And this is rich not just in the monetary sense, but in the fullness of being able to enjoy the stuff that you got, which I talked about last week. Solomon said, you know, one of the great evils is people get all this wealth and they can't enjoy it. But God is the one who gives you the ability to enjoy it, but he gives it to that ability to the ones who please him. Therefore, please him, and then you'll be able to enjoy the stuff. Hosea 2:8 is a sad passage. God's lamenting the fact that the nation of Israel is taking the stuff that he gave her and using it to serve another god. The point is in here, it's that God who gave them corn, wine, and oil, it's God who multiplied for silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. And the interesting thing about God is he did this knowing that they would do that. So just because God has given a person wealth or riches doesn't mean he's pleased with them. It's something that they have to be responsible for. Deuteronomy 7:11, and I encourage you, if you want to study this more, go back and read the context, because I had to cut out some really cool verses in here. But thus you shall keep the commandments of the Lord. It goes on to say in verse 12 about how they have to know them and observe them and keep them. Then God will love you and bless you and multiply you. He will love you, and that's the hesed, the word for loyalty. And you shall be blessed above all people, not be male or female barren among you or your cattle, and the Lord will take away all your sickness, and you're going to do well. All the causes of poverty that my slightly amoral PhD came up with are the things that God eliminates. He said he'll eliminate those things. Who's the one who's doing it? God. Why is he doing it? Because people are obeying him. Like, real simple. Wealth is also a consequence of wisdom. Wisdom, as we saw previous weeks, is choosing the right objective and the right means of obtaining that objective. And, you know, bad guys can get rich because they are wise. They just follow the principles of wisdom. Of course, they leave the God picture out, and then the wealth does them harm. But they get it by following what God says you should do to get it. The crown of the wise is their riches. The foolishness of fools is folly. So if you're wise, you'll eventually get riches. If you're foolish, you eventually get nothing. Speaking of wisdom in Proverbs 3:16, length of days is in her right hand, and her left hand are riches and honor. And again in 8:18, with wisdom is durable riches and righteousness. Durable riches, things that endure. Ezekiel 28:4. With you wisdom and with your wisdom and with your understanding you have gotten your riches. You have gotten gold and silver into your treasuries. By your great wisdom and by your traffic or trade you have increased your riches. And danger, warning, Will Robinson, your heart is lifted up because of your riches. This is a great passage of fulfilled prophecy. This is about Tyre. And Tyre was the head of the Phoenician Empire, and that they were the major traders in the Mediterranean Sea, pre-Israelite. And these guys, by their wisdom, by their understanding, by their wise trading, had become fabulously wealthy. And if you go back and read the context, you said, they became God. We are God. We can do whatever we want. I guess we don't have to worry about anybody thinking like that today. Fortunately, we do. Because once you can do whatever you want, aren't you God? The only thing I can't do is prolong my life. Like, actually, I can prolong it. I just can't determine that I live forever. But, and then God says, because of this, I'm going to smack you so hard, no one's going to find you again. And what happens is Alexander the Great comes down, and they just scrape the city bare. It's all thrown into the sea. That was the prophecy. And all of Tyre goes into the sea to build the causeway onto the island where they just got slaughtered by Alexander. So here, their wealth got them all this. Their arrogancy extracted God's notice, and God said, you guys are toast. And they were. Knowledge helps you get wisdom. Proverbs 24:4. By wisdom, a house or business is founded. By understanding, it's established. And then by knowledge, the chambers shall be filled with all precious and pleasant riches. Remember, I got one of my bosses once upon a time to start reading the Bible because I had just read this in Proverbs, and we're talking about, can the Bible show you how to get money? And I said, sure. And he had a Living Bible and pulled it out and looked. And the Living Bible, it's great because it just shows how a business is, prospers by keeping abreast of the facts. And he said, wow, that's in the Bible. That's actually good stuff. This is a guy who had basically made his bundle by being a diligent worker guy. Wealth is also a consequence of labor. Yeah, you got to work for it. Sorry. Proverbs 13:11, wealth gotten by vanity shall diminish, but that he who gathers by labor shall increase. So, labor's a good thing. We're actually in the New Testament commanded to work and labor so we can give. And we'll look at that verse in future weeks. One of my favorite verses on this subject is Proverbs 22:4. By humility and fear of the Lord are riches, honor, and life. But what do you want? Riches, honor, and life? I mean, how do you get it? Well, according to this inerrant word, it's humility and fear of the Lord. Fear of the Lord means you don't want to disobey him. And humility means you accept the stuff that he's given you, knowing that he gives what's best when it's best. You don't exalt yourself or look yourself up or grasp or stuff. You just do the stuff that you're supposed to do, and then God provides it. Speaking of the fear of the Lord, Psalm 112:3. Is a whole psalm about the man who fears the Lord and says, wealth and riches shall be in his house. And as a bonus, not actually as a bonus, but his righteousness will endure forever is a major piece. Because wealth and riches don't do you any good when you're gone. Righteousness, another good item that follows from that. Proverbs 11:28, he who trusts in his riches shall fail, but the righteous shall flourish as a branch. Faithfulness, a faithful man shall abound with blessings. He who makes haste to get rich shall not be innocent. Because a person who makes haste to get rich cuts corners and does stuff they're not supposed to do and sets himself up for judgment. So here, this is a sermon on faithfulness. And one of the ways your things you're supposed to be faithful with is your money. And if you're faithful with your money and other things, you actually get more blessings. Works for me. Two other means that people hope for. One is inheritance. That's how some people get their money and then they lose it. From shirt sleeves to long sleeves to shirt sleeves and three generations is something how it goes. The first guy works, rolls up his sleeves and works, pulls up a bunch. His next generation, have the long sleeves and they don't have to work, they just take it easy. And then the generation after them, they kind of lose it all. Just like, it's just this cycle. Riches don't endure forever. But inheritance is one of the ways people get it. houses and riches are inheritances of the Lord, our fathers, but the real good gift is a prudent wife from the Lord. Praise that one. And then luck. Yeah, luck actually happens. World's wisest man, Solomon, observes people and figures out about life. And he says, I returned and I saw under the sun that the race is not always to the swift, the battle not always to the strong, neither the bread to the wise, nor riches to the men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happens to them all. The way you can translate these Hebrew verbs is like it always, it's not always to that. You basically want to bet on the swift, the strong, the wise, and the people understanding, the people of skill. That's kind of where the odds are going to fall out. But odds are odds. It's a probability. There's always a chance that it doesn't happen. And time and chance happens to all. So that's riches are so uncertain, you don't want to trust in them. But you can set the odds in your favor, and that's a function of luck. So people who tend to follow these things would tend to have an increase of financial reserves. People who don't, there's actually a flip side to each of those, which I don't need to point out. You can figure that out yourself. You'll lose it. Now, poverty, on the other hand, is considered a consequence of other factors. And it's the opposite of some of the stuff above, but I specified a few where the scriptures specified them. Laziness. Proverbs 10:24. He becomes poor that deals with a slack hand. If I was teaching at a Christian school, I would say, he fails who deals with a slack hand. The students who don't do well are the ones who are not diligent. Diligence is a precious possession of a man. So putting the effort in and following through, even when you don't feel like doing it, is the key to success in so many areas. And it's one of the things parents need to ingrain in their kids. Otherwise, they'll wind up having to support the kids for the rest of their lives. Hand of the diligent makes rich. So that's one of the major problems of poverty is people who are... You have two people who grow up in the same village. One amasses wealth and winds up leaving the village. The other guy stays there. What's the difference? One of them just worked harder than the other. Now, admittedly, you can have two people working equally hard and time and chance happen to both of them and one gets lucky and one doesn't. But over the long haul, the person who is diligent will succeed. Whenever I read stories of people who have pulled themselves out of nothing to fabulous wealth and stuff, one of the things I find really interesting is most of them have won or made and lost multiple fortunes. They have nothing, they make a fortune, they lose a fortune. They make a fortune, they lose a fortune. It's kind of, and they just have the same, here they are, they've lost again. All right, but they put the same diligence back to work, and they make it. And then they get stupid, and they lose it. And then they put the diligence, and they make it. And it's just you'll see this reflected all over life. B, no self-control, no self-discipline, no self-denial. Ooh, nasty words. Yeah, but necessary. Proverbs 21:20, there's treasure to be desired and oil in the dwelling of the wise. Okay, this is a verse that's used for saying you shouldn't get rid of all your stuff. A wise person is going to have stores of these things in their house. But the foolish man spends it all up. They have holes in their pocket. They got money, put it in, boom, gone. But God also says that one of his curses for people who disobey him is he says, I'll put holes in your pocket. I'll put, holes that when you put your money in, it just disappears. And I'm not sure if it's literal holes, but I'm sure it isn't just literal holes, but I do see the way some of my students handle their wealth. And it just, here today, gone tomorrow. The fool just cannot save because they have to immediately gratify their desires. Who knows, I might not get the chance to do it again, boom. And as a result, they lose it. I remember when I got out of college, I read a couple books on money, and one of which was something called The Wealthiest Man, or The Wealthy Barber of Babylon, or something like that. I don't know if you've heard that one, but it's basically about a guy who saved, and as a result, he gets interest on his interest, and he lives happily ever after and becomes the richest man in his town. I read a bio of a guy who has done interesting things with his money called John Templeton, and he said when he and his wife were first married, they just used crates for their furniture. They just sat on cardboard boxes, and the table was a crate. Because he recognized that if he spent the money on that couch, he would lose all the future benefit of that money. So he saved it, invested it, and as a result has been able to donate millions and millions and millions of dollars through his Templeton, not just fund, but philanthropy as a result. I think eventually his wife got some nice furniture, but I guess I reached a point. But it helped me think of the fact that, yeah, if you consume this stuff now, you pay for that the rest of your life. You don't have it. And you don't have it generating additional income to you. Now, you don't want to hoard stuff, but you want to be wise. And the whole principle that I'm developing out of this faithfulness stuff is use it according to God's purposes. There's giving, there's being generous, there's God using your riches to delight you. There's all kinds of stuff that will come next couple sermons on how God wants you to use it. But one of the ways of getting it is not spending it, or basically being controlled in your use of it. Loving pleasure is actually a bad thing, particularly those of us who are pleasure puppies. That's a hard verse, but Proverbs 21:17, he that loves pleasure shall be a poor man, and he who loves wine and oil shall not be rich. Well, why is that? Because you're going to spend it on your pleasure. You're going to spend it on stuff that we eventually find out doesn't satisfy. Someone who's greedy also kind of winds up getting poor. Some irony in that. Proverbs 28:22, he who hastens to be rich has an evil eye, doesn't consider that poverty shall come upon him. So there's lots of folks who will neglect their relationship with God, and they will pursue money, and money eventually becomes their God, and then the money goes bye-bye. Because God says, I'm not going to let you do that. I care about you. I want you back with me. And your money is basically standing between you and me, so we'll get rid of it for you. Nice of them, actually. It's a blessing. Well, it isn't usually recognized. Here's a verse that a lot of people have a hard time with. I probably do, too. Proverbs 15:5. The one who basically endures and gets blessed is he who does not put his money out at usury, nor takes a bribe or reward against the innocent. Okay, we can understand the last part. You know, don't take bribes against the innocent. That's one of the things that perverts justice in so many places, and what the poor has gets swept away because of that injustice. But this bit about usury, or what is considered usurious, high interest rates is kind of, there's some people who say you cannot loan your money out to get interest out of it. And why? Get interest on it. There are some people who do that. There are some people who say, no, usury doesn't refer to just getting interest. It refers to excessive rates of usury. And coming from a capitalist country where capital has a cost, I understand interest rates are very essential for things being developed. So I'd probably slide with the group that say usury is excessively high amounts of interest. And one of the things that I read as I was looking at these microloans, they are micro amounts, but they carry full hefty price tags in terms of interest. And people are exploiting these folks by loaning them money at high rates. So much injustice happens because of that. Poverty is a consequence of oppression and bribes. He who oppresses the poor to increase his riches, and he who gives to the rich shall surely come to want, because God will judge them, and they're going to lose it. That's one of the major problems in countries that we call third world countries that really haven't developed economically, is the governments are corrupt. Major. And they confiscate people's stuff and they confiscate their property. If you don't have property, you tend not to be able to progress. So as I look through history, this week I'm doing the Greeks. And I ask the questions, okay, why did the Greeks do well as a civilization? And you look through their history and you find out that they say, we got our wisdom from Athena. And it's the serpent wisdom, and it's actually what you delve in deeper to it. They took the principles of the Old Testament, removed God, put Satan in his place, and they're using a lot of the principles of the Old Testament in order to prosper. So another thing that kind of helped them become a democracy, it's there was one leader that they had, Cleisthenes or somebody like that. I can never pronounce these old Greek names. And he structured things so farmers could get honest, low-cost loans to improve their farms. So they had a farm, they were able to buy it, improve it, and as a result they got greater yields. Now they had an economic surplus. What did they do with that yield? Two things happened from it. One is they traded it, but in order to trade it, you had to put it in something. So the whole Greek urn thing, Greek vase, all those things, rises up. And I was telling my class about these. It's a major art form. One of these things went for auction for like $2 or $3 million for this little thing. One of the things that fueled the development of this is they needed stuff to store their olive oil in because their crops were reducing. And then the artistry of it, one of the guys writes on it, this was done by, you know, Demetrius or somebody like that, and at the bottom he says, which is better than Zahotis could have done. You know, it's like, it's the individualism that caused him to, you know, do a little better job on the stuff. So the Greek civilization was able to expand because of their wise use of capital. They didn't just spend it, they invested it, their surplus, they traded, and as a result, they did hugely well. Oppression and bribes. G, poor priorities. Proverbs 23:4 is a really good warning. Labor not to be rich. Cease from your own wisdom. Remember, I was standing outside Carnegie Hall about 15 years ago, talking to a young man who was just getting married. And his father was a chairman of the board of elders in a church. And, you know, this guy had a really bright future. And he was getting into one of these multi-level marketing schemes, kind of like an Amway thing. And I was kind of warning him against that because I said, almost everyone I know who has been involved in something like that spends all their time talking about their business. They don't spend a whole lot of time talking about Jesus. And he said, well, no, you don't understand. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to make my first million, and then I'm going to go into the Lord's work. As far as I know, he's still chasing that first million. Lord's work still isn't done, because this guy is out there thinking, oh, this is going to get it, this is going to get it. And here he had this rich heritage, and when he stands before God, God's going to say, were you faithful with the truth I gave you? With the truth you heard as you were growing up? Were you faithful with the positions I put you in? Well, no, Lord, I was going to, but, you know, I just couldn't get my first million first. You know, I needed that. It's like, foolish guy, wrong values. It's tragic. Poor priorities. Labor not to be rich, cease from your own wisdom. Will you set your eyes on that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves as wings. They fly away as an eagle towards the heaven. And I guess in light of this week, they also plummet down to the depths pretty fast as well. Unless you were short, you were unhappy. Poverty is a consequence of stuff gotten unrighteously, and you lose it. Jeremiah 17:11. He who gets riches and not by right shall leave them in the midst of his days, and in the end shall be a fool. Can't take it with you. I remember seeing a cartoon when I was young in the New Yorker. It showed a guy showing, you know, this group of people in line for the pearly gates, and, you know, they're all dressed in their, you know, just like they're like sheets kind of thing, and they're there waiting for St. Peter to call them up into heaven. And then there's this guy coming by, he's got this boat-sized Cadillac, this giant U-Haul behind it, the cigar and everything. Two of the guys online stand and says, I thought you couldn't take it with you. Well, that's just a cartoon, you can't take it with you. A couple weeks I'm going to talk about how you can send it on ahead, but you know, you all have to get left here behind. And then neglect. You can have achieved a certain level of wealth. In fact, anybody who lives in the United States is wealthy by the world standards. When Jill and I graduated from college, we had a friend who was from India. And his name was Rupen Das. And his brother was going to come to visit. And so after his brother had come, we asked him, what was your brother's impression of America? And, you know, he kind of gave us a whole list of things. And he said, and one of the things was he was just amazed because he had never seen fat, poor people. Because in America, our poor people are heavy. And he said, one of the first things my brother said to me, he patted my stomach, he said, oh, you're looking very prosperous there. But people lose it because they neglect. Proverbs 27:23, be diligent to know the state of your flocks, because riches are not forever. And you need to take care of the stuff that God has entrusted to you. Remember, this is all about a stewardship. If you neglect it, you lose it. Proverbs 24 ends with, I went by the field of the slothful, by the vineyard of the man void of understanding. Everybody saw? You know, the walls were broken down, the vineyard was in disrepair, the little animals could come in and get it. And then he said, so your poverty come upon you like a armed man, and your want like disaster. You know, an armed man comes and takes all your stuff from you. So the little sleep, the little slumber, the little neglect caused a large loss. That's one of the things that frequently causes poverty. People neglect stuff, and as a result, difficulties ensue. So as I understand the scriptures, wealth and poverty are just consequences. If you do certain stuff, God will bless you. If you do other stuff, you'll lose it. Either God's direct intervention or because you're following the wrong path. Now, bad people can follow good principles and get rich, but it doesn't profit them, and they usually don't enjoy it. Now, I'm sure there's going to be the exceptions that kind of demonstrate the rule. There are going to be people who are bad people who enjoy the stuff. But you just give them 20, 30 years and then see what happens. In their life, it's not going to profit. So God does want to bless us, but you have to be righteous in order for that to get it and enjoy it. All right, questions on what I said or some of the ones down below? We got 10 minutes. Yeah, sure, Kat.
I was just, so there's a number in the New Testament, right? There's adults that they did as the sacrifice, mm-hmm. which was how righteous.
All right. If you think about Mary and Joseph as a specific example, although this is not, this is going to be the exception to the case you're asking about, I think part of God's purpose was to have Jesus born in the most humble of circumstances. It was prophesied that way. That way he represents every man. You know, so that's probably going to be part of the scheme for that, is that he wasn't born into privilege, but he was Savior of all from the lowest on up. But the broader principle is you do have folks in the New Testament times who were, you know, basically poor. We have to think about, how do you define poverty? What people do for defining poverty now is they pick a certain dollar number and they compare it to other dollar numbers. And absolute poverty versus relative poverty. Well, poverty right now is relative. If you're below this certain dollar level, you're poor. Well, what's the number in the United, poverty level in the United States? It's like 12, 20, what? And that's per month. 16,000. Yeah, 16,000, right. Okay, then you have someone in India who lives on $360 a year. They had that amount of money, woo, you know, they would be rich. So when you define poverty as a dollar amount, you start running into problems. I would define poverty more in terms of, do you have enough to eat? You have a place to sleep, and are you free from large amounts of oppression? You know, so the people in Jerusalem and Israel at that time, they had those things. They wouldn't be wealthy or rich. Jesus said, on one hand, the poor you'll always have with you, and you can help them whenever you want. But God said in the Old Testament, there will be no poor among you if you as a nation are obeying me. So we look at Israel at the New Testament times. Were they obeying God? All right, so he couldn't bless them. In fact, you know, it's hard to find times in Israel history when they were obeying God, except under David and Solomon, and then they kind of lost it. So they were never following the prescription, hence they did not get it. As you move further into the New Testament, you find folks who had made themselves poor for the sake of the kingdom. Yeah. But then you find people that are doing well. Lydia, Asian seller of purple in the Philippian church, basically funded all of Paul's missionary journeys. I mean, she was the major contributor to the church. That was the only church that supported him. You know, there are people that God could use that. So you're going to find people on both ends of the spectrum. Yeah, hands.
Another way to look at $100 million. Who's wealthy? Dollars in the bank. Other person clearly is.
Yeah, the default is poverty. Most of the world, through most of history, has lived in what we would call very poor circumstances. They've lived oppressed, and they get by. Yeah, that's the way life tends to be, and then there are other things that cause it to be different. Randy? We're in decline on a number of metrics, you know, or deficits, or, you know, the gap between the rich and the poor goes up. Is that, you know, there are people getting richer, there are more and more millionaires every day than they've ever been before any time in history, yet as a country, we have abandoned the things that I think made us great and are in decline. Abandoned a moral code. We don't have self-control or restraint. It's just a matter of time before, you know, we follow the path of all previous civilizations. Yeah, Elaine.
I don't know if I'm being legal. I mean, I feel legal.
Well, that's a really good question. How do you know if you're doing God's will or not? That's really what you're asking. you know you're doing God's will if you've seen the scriptures and God has communicated through basically the acrostic of his will, through the word, through counsel, input from others, through logic, and through some of the subjective things that you are doing or not doing God's will. One of the basic principles is if you don't work, you don't eat. So while you're waiting on God to provide the wonderful thing, do some temp work. And we've seen, actually, a number of you have gotten your jobs through temp work, right? I mean, you actually went to temp, you got some temp jobs just to fill in the gap, and lo and behold, through that, God provided, built out of nothing, jobs that you love. I mean, it's amazing. God does that. So it's really hard to justify a person just sitting there doing nothing, because, as the scriptures say, First Thess, don't work, don't eat. So waiting on God while, you're able to meet your own needs, that could be the wise thing. Like people who, particularly in the arts, that's such a strange, for more white reasons than one, profession, because it's not a constant thing. It's like if you're a farmer, it was pretty easy. There's a time to do this, time to do that. It's like you know where the field is. But if you're in the arts, it's like, well, where's my next job coming from? When are we going to get this? And it's kind of wise to be really tapped into God to know what he wants you to do in between. And that's one of the tougher professions. But for most other people, it's like things are more scheduled. And yeah.
So remember that the Bible says, not money, love it. Parables when man left a certain amount of gold with each of his servants. And the one who was damned when he came back was the one which is. The Bible is clear that first seek righteousness, seek God, and the other things we read in the Bible suggest being lazy. Or that matter, having money, value system you have. I would say just sit there and use it.
Yeah, the basic idea behind accumulating wealth, you can figure this out by asking, why do they pay you at work? Some of you actually do wonder that. Why do they pay me? Ultimately, each one of us gets paid because we serve others. We meet someone else's need. I ask my students, why do you give me some of your tuition? They can't figure it out. But I serve their need for some general education, life skills, and knowledge for their future. Now, Christians, what's our basic job description in life? Serve others. I mean, we should be really good at this. That's our thing. And a lot of you have stood out at work because you serve your bosses, you serve your company. You're a light because that doesn't happen. And that's going to get your light's going to get increasingly bright because a lot of your contemporaries are, doesn't everything exist for me? and one of the things I read in some of the management stuff I read is how do I handle these kids who think they're always at summer camp? This whole generation. It's like we have to change all our policies because it just doesn't work. But the idea of serving others. So you have this person, they can always be serving. Have opportunities to serve. I remember one of my Time in Your Life seminars, when I was doing the project planner thing, we used to scholarship lots of people, homeless people as well, to come to some of our classes. And one of the guys raises his hand and says, talk about how to solve a problem. Okay, what kind of problem do you want to solve? Nobody will give me a job. So that's his problem. Nobody will give him a job. So then we threw it into a project planner and we looked at it, what's the really real problem? And eventually, as we defined it, we realized, he needed to define and articulate to an employer how it would be in the employer's best interest to hire him. That's the issue. It's not that nobody will give you a job. It's you haven't shown someone how it's in their interest to hire you. You haven't shown them how you will serve them. Well, maybe you don't know how to serve. Maybe you don't have any skills. Then that's the thing you need to work on first. I need to get skills so I can serve others with them. One of my first jobs out of college, at a guy who was a pretty wealthy businessman who met this cute little girl in a sandwich shop and who eventually became his girlfriend. And he said, I'm going to make you the manager of something, of a restaurant or something. So he forms this company and gets a contract to run a college food service. And obviously this gal knew how to make a sandwich, but didn't know how to do it. So they found me to run the thing. And in order to get this contract, they had to bid really, really high. It's like, we'll give the college so much of a kickback, but we'll keep our prices low, so the students can afford it if you give us this job. So I'm there, and I'm looking, how do I make the numbers work on this? And fortunately, I found out about a program that the county would pay half the salary of people if I hired them out of their training programs. I just cut my payroll costs in half. You know, I hired a bunch of people, and then I realized there are reasons why these people had to go through a training program. But, you know, as a means of helping people, training them in job skills is, you know, one of the things you can do to help them. You know, it's another story, progress. But the idea is they need to serve, they need to learn how to serve. This guy in my 12th seminar needed to learn how do I serve my employer. One of the things I used to say, I haven't said this in a while yet, if you want to figure out how to get, you know, more income on your job, figure out how to increase your service. Because rewards are always proportionate to your service. It's like the more you serve, the more you normally get compensated for it, unless there's some extraordinary things going on. Well, when I first asked myself that question of the tension between, you know, giving all your time to your job, and they will take as much as they can get. I mean, this is how you get to be a boss. I can bring blood from a stone. Great, you're a manager. All right. And then what about the stuff that God's put me on this planet for? The two aren't unrelated because you do your work heartily for the Lord and stuff like that, but there's other stuff that God has clearly specified. And the solution was toil, to encourage people to set objectives in those five areas of your life. So work is one of the five areas that God is eventually going to judge you on. But there's also your personal growth, your spiritual growth, your relationships, and your ministry, these other areas. So you need to keep them in balance. So there are times when you have to make some hard decisions of, I can't give my boss everything they ask for, because then I can't give God everything he asks for. And one of our understandings of the scripture is God always gives you all you need to do his will. Right, so all I have to do is figure out what is God's will in this situation. And for the most part, it's going to be 80-20. For the most part, if you're a Christian working like you're supposed to be working, you're already giving your employer much more than they're paying you. So, you know, you can give them the 80-20 on some of the stuff and just, you know, give them the 20% that gives them 80% of the result, and that normally would make them happy. One of the questions you always have to be asking, to what standard do I need to do this job? Remember, I was talking to somebody at Vince's, one of his places of employment, about time management, and she said she's, you know, there until 10 o'clock every night. And I said, why are you here until 10 o'clock every night? Well, I have to rewrite all my subordinates' reports. And I said, why do you have to do that? And I said, because they're not done right. And I said, well, does the client require them to be done differently? No. Does your boss require them to be done differently? No, but they're just not done right. So I said, oh, what you have here is a hobby. That's why you're here at night. You're doing your hobby. It's something that you enjoy doing. It doesn't have to be done. This is not what you're getting paid for. You're just doing it because you enjoy doing it. You're here doing your hobby until 10 o'clock at night. And, you know, it's this balance. What do we get out of what we put in? You had a question.
I was going to take it back up. Am I in a dangerous thinking? So to the point of working to be rich, I'm not working to be rich. I definitely serve at work. I'm pretty good at that. But my little joke is, I don't work at work because I love to be at work and like honor my work more than that. I work for my time off. So that's, you know, travel.
Morning, Will Robinson. Yeah, we have that's a really good topic. In next week, we talk about giving to yourself, and I actually address that next week. So since it's almost sandwich time, let's address that next week. Yeah, stay tuned. And then the week after that, we're going to talk about giving to God, and then we'll move on to some of the other topics. So let's close in prayer. Thank you, Father, that you're God who does richly bless, who gives us all things to enjoy, who opens his hand and satisfies the desire of every living thing. That you've also revealed yourself to be a God who calls people into account, who has a will to be done, and who will judge us on the basis of how we've done it. I pray that you'd give us wisdom to know how to use what you've given us for your purposes and for your glory. I pray you'd show us where we are stepping outside your will, and give us joy in showing us that we're on target and doing the things that you hire us to do. I pray that you cause each person here to prosper, not just financially, but in all the other ways that you desire. Our soul would be whole, our joy would be whole, and they would hear the words, well done, good and faithful servant. Help us be faithful, because we acknowledge that we need your help to do it. Thanks for your truth to guide us, an example of others. I pray all these things in Christ's name. Amen.